Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to our continuing video discussion regarding the six stages of discipleship at the end of that book, Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1. I think it's Section 3. We have completed the 13th program, and the segue to it goes as follows. When the demand of the aspirant, the guiding disciple's recommendation, the karmic condition and the note which the master registers, because after all, he has the greatest ability to register and will know something about the karma which lies ahead. When they coincide in time, then the third stage is reached, and that will be the stage of accepted discipleship. I had a little difficulty yesterday. I had some time to do a program, but this particular text, with all of its highlighting, it disappeared, and it took me 5 hours to find a way to retrieve it. So that's the kind of thing you don't want to happen. But later, not only will you have the video programs for this six stages of discipleship, but you will have as well the text program, such as we're looking at now. And you may find it useful. All of these programs are done in a more conversational style, and it's my hope that they will be of value to you that way. Now, there's lots of commentaries on Makara which are done in the normal written form, and I think I reviewed those with you. So you have plenty to study. I mean, you're simply studying the Tibetan's books without my comments would be a lot. But I hope to lead the mind of the student to some associations which otherwise he or she might not consider, might not think upon. So let's go on. I don't think this will be a long program because I have a Cosmic Fire program coming up. I'd like to do those long programs, you know. Somehow it seems like something is really being accomplished. On the other hand, it puts maybe a little more burden on you. You have to note the timing where you stop if you're listening carefully and viewing. And that's not so bad a task. And then when you pick up, you pick up at that point. The Tibetan says, get a little closer here to the screen. I would here again remind you that all these stages are related to work in the ashram, to the life and vitality of the inner group. This group is composed, as you know, of old and experienced disciples and initiates, and also of neophytes, obviously beginners, relatively, and also of neophytes in various stages of development, and also of disciples passing through the many different stages of the path. So there is a gradation always in these matters, and we have to simply accept, once we understand, the factual nature of that gradation. It's true that some move ahead, he follows after, and some move behind, and he sets the pace. That's for any disciple. It's the great chain of hierarchy. And the Tibetan advises us, you know, all of this has to be factually considered without any criticism or belittlement of those behind or ahead, because such an attitude will reap nothing but problems. It is these widely different types of active disciples which bring about the interrelation between the outer and the inner ashrams, and that there must be if there's going to be continuity of expression from within to without. Between the objective group upon the outer plane, such as the ones that Master DK drew together, and the very much larger inner group. If we think that the ashram consists of those few that we know on the outer plane and who are working accordingly on the on outer tasks, we're very much mistaken. It's backed up by a large inner group. And this brings me, he says, to a question which may quite normally arise in the minds of those working in the outer group and loosely related to the inner group. That relationship has to tighten and the bonds have to be more secure. Is the level of the consciousness of the outer ashram determined by the personnel of that group or by its relation to the whole ashram of which it forms a relatively small part? I'm hoping I haven't done this somehow and sent it to you, but let's just say every time I work on something like this, I never repeat exactly the same thing. So is the level of the consciousness of the outer ashram determined by the personnel of that group or by its relation to the whole ashram of which it is a part? When this question is posited by a member of an ashram, it indicates a definite preoccupation with the personnel of the group and not with the group as an aspect of some master's ashram. We're so likely to evaluate each other, judge each other, criticize each other, find fault with each other, and want to be in a status superior to the other, which of course indicates, if it exists, that we're very far from the spirit which pervades the ashram. So when this question is posited by a member of an ashram, it indicates a definite preoccupation with the personnel of the group and not with the group as an aspect of the master's ashram. There are so many little egotistical things which have to be transcended as we attempt to live beyond the ordinary human preoccupations with power and status and authority, all gathered from keeping our eye too much upon the personal self of our own personal self and the personal self of others. Disciples need to remember that an ashram is not confined to a few who may know each other and who may even meet together as ashram members. Interesting, you know, the group of 14 in New York met with Alice Bailey at the time of the of each full moon, and the ashram would be discussed. Alice Bailey was an experienced ashramic worker, and she would be in a position to enlighten the others who were obviously members of the outer group surrounding an ashram, to enlighten them as to the true modes and methods, the two true processes, and the state of mind of the ashramic members. What's an ashram? One of the definitions, the state of mind of a spiritual group. So not just for the few who may meet together even as ashramic members. An ashram is, and this is of course now with our communications system much more obvious, an ashram is an international group. It is composed of souls in incarnation and out of incarnation. It is a synthesis of initiates of various degrees and of accepted disciples. One must be at least an accepted disciple, really, to hover on the periphery of an ashram. And D.K. treated later his group of 24 in the new reorganized C group in that manner, as accepted disciples, even one of them not having taken the first initiation. The masters do not regard those who have taken the first initiation as initiates. This is a point which needs re-emphasis. Now, there were a lot of DK students who simply had taken the first initiation. They were, in a way, can we say probationary initiates, or must we reserve that term for those who have also taken the second degree? So the ashram is a synthesis of initiates of various degrees and of accepted disciples. And that's why it's so important, I think, for us to move towards the stage of accepted disciple and understand what it requires and whether we are, in a sense, making the grade. Because obviously we will be in a position to be of greater value in service and on more intimate terms with the real ashram when we do make the grade. So many people talk about, you know, being the member of an ashram, but those are glib statements which are not backed by an understanding of the true requirements. So an international group composed of souls in incarnation and out of incarnation. I mean, imagine that you knew somebody that was, after all, definitely indicating by behavior and knowledge and understanding and attitude that he or she was a member of the ashram, then that person passes over into the inner worlds, and that person is still, though out of incarnation, a member of the ashram. And to define that and make it more real to us, Master D.K., in the beginning of his book, Discipleship in the New Age, told us what certain of those who had passed over were doing in connection with his work or the work of Master Moria. There were several. I'm remembering these were war years when he was writing this, and CDP was helping with the children who had been killed in the war, lost their body in the war, and I suppose helping them make the transition. And was it PDW? I'm not sure about those letters, but the man was a former Jesuit priest who had worked on the second ray, but basically belonged to Master Moria. Well, he was helping DK for a while, and then he moved into his true ashram, which probably reflected his monadic ray. Another individual, was it K-E-S? S as in Sam, who was a military man, and he was working with soldiers who had been killed during the war. There were a few. And he says, please regard those on the inner side still as members of the ashram, maybe even more so. They are in a position to be closer to the inner group and closer to the master's instructions. And he said, I think also when you're doing your triangles, don't abandon those who have passed over. They're still very much capable of participating in that type of exercise. So we have to get used to the idea that the ashram is a large inner group. international in scope, and maybe some of those who are in it we have known personally, either now or in earlier times, or we'll get to know them, and others we don't know personally at all. So this expands our mind, doesn't it, on these matters. Disciples, this is where I got the idea. Disciples who have taken the second initiation, and maybe not the first, are regarded as probationary initiates. They have entered the stream, and about them much is said in the writings or translation by Blavatsky of The Secret of the Golden Flower. They are swept along by the ashramic current towards the ashram, and they swim on their own, and they are helped also. And only when they have taken the third initiation are they truly initiate from the standpoint of the hierarchy. So we can think of these initiations of the threshold as important, as indicative, but not as indicating from the hierarchical point of view true initiatory status. And sometimes DK talks about the first initiation, and we might not really know, is he speaking of the first initiation from the hierarchical perspective, or is he talking about the birth of the Christ in the heart and the achievement of little chelaship? The context will have to reveal that to us. And there's different ways of naming these initiations. The first initiation is sometimes spoken of as the Lemurian initiation. It has a lot to do with the etheric physical nature, and so did the kinds of initiations offered in Lemuria millions of years ago. And the second as the Atlantean initiation, but the third initiation, that of our Aryan race, pertaining particularly to our Aryan race, a term which denotes consciousness and not Nordic or Germanic roots, that is technically regarded by them as the first initiation. And I would like you, this is the new angle. Well, maybe to us who've been reading all this for a long time, it no longer seems quite new, but to the reader who comes along, yes, I think it's going to be quite new. And I'll kind of, put some colors here that are indicative, and we'll see. But the third initiation is the Aryan, that of our Aryan race. We really do have to, and I think it's happening, save the word Aryan from the terrible connotations which it took on during the racially charged Second World War. So yeah, this Aryan initiation, and every true disciple is aiming to be initiated. This Aryan initiation is regarded by them, the masters, as the first initiation. And this is a new angle upon which I would ask you to think. I would, you know, use the color orange, except it's not available to me. Although, as well, we might say that the color indigo, being an esoteric color of the fifth ray, which is the ruler of the third initiation, might serve as well. Okay, this is a new angle, and I'd ask you to think about that, okay? The term, therefore, of accepted disciple covers the stage of the first and second initiations. Many were those who had not yet achieved the second, but had that special relationship established by Master DK with them, which means he took greater responsibility for their training, and that was, yeah, before they took the second degree. So when the disciple has taken the third, he is no longer technically an accepted disciple, even though he still remains in a master's group until he has taken the fourth initiation, at which point some of these initiates of the fourth degree can begin to form their own ashrams. So a new angle here. And maybe it will help to illumine our way to a certain extent. Because I think it's important that these initiations be expeditiously prepared for. The world stands in need, even, he tells us, of fifth degree initiates. So we have to know the process of becoming qualified in those higher ways. He's part of a master's group until he has taken the fourth initiation, but probably a group, we might say, within the aura. From the time you are a third degree initiate, you can be in that fifth stage of discipleship, which is called chela within the master's aura. I am, he says, pointing out these technicalities so that there may be clarity and proportion in your thinking. It's so easy to exaggerate one status, the status of others, or to minimize their status, and which, as he says, would indicate you're thinking too much of the personnel and not of the great, greater ashramic goal. Where would we be instructed in such clarity and detail about the workings of an ashram, if not here and in this way, by Master DK? I know of no other teacher who instructs in this particular manner. Now, naturally, every teacher instructs differently, and the various teachers have much to offer, But here we're looking at a, I think, quite a glamour-free presentation that we can adopt as we move forward, following the rules of the road, and a presentation which helps disabuse ourselves of all the normal, glamorous traps, illusory traps. We don't seek to become a deluded disciple, no matter how comfortable temporarily that particular state of delusion might be for us psychologically. An ashram is, he says, therefore, representative of all stages of unfoldment, from the most advanced, because, you know, it's possible to have a master who has masters in his own ashram, a kind of, what does he call it, blending of the lights. And although I have, there's a lot of third ray, I think, in Master Decay combining with the second, this is my impression. And of course, if I am disabused of a fallacy, I'll be happy about it somewhere along the line. I have thought about Master Decay ruling the 2-sub-3 ashram, but he has said there are 5 masters working with me in the ashram, and he would have to be ruling then. Ruling, is that a good word? Officiating over, inspiring, whatever. The second ashram, 2-sub-2, which would have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 5 of them, 5 masters under his supervision. And Master KH, of course, would be the head of the entire ashram. And sometimes I have thought that Master KH's role would be in the 2-sub-2, but it's much more than that. It's the whole thing of any of the secondary ashram at this point. So I'll have to clarify that as I go. And I know that you may have heard me say this and that, and then later say something which may challenge the this and that that I earlier said. Well, I'm, you know, fallible and only human, and I will correct my errors as I go along, or if I think there may be an error that needs pondering, I will indicate it. So an ashram is, therefore, representative of all stages of unfoldment, from the most advanced to beginners, such as those who read these instructions, and that's putting us, you know, in place, I think. We may have received some of this material a little sooner than others who will become interested in it later, but let's face it, we are beginners. We are neophytes when compared to those who are solidly in the ashram, solidly within the master's aura. You know, in that picture of Master Decay, he's surrounded by 2 disciples. Master Decay is sitting. One looks very much on the second ray. the expression in the eyes and so forth. The other looks quite a bit on the first ray. And in a picture such as that, photo, you have to imagine that these two are not just beginners, but are fairly close co-workers with the master in ashramic matters. The point of importance to each disciple in an ashram is whether he can step up his consciousness and his conscious response to ashramic vibration so that he does not hinder the planned activity of the ashram. Well, that's it. He's telling us in various ways and in various places that the level of the ashram is not judged or does not exist according to the lowest common denominator. The neophytes benefit, but they do not set the level, and the stimulation is upon them, and they may feel it, working under the master's gaze as a particular burden. I think Master DK mentions this, and I have the impression that quite a few of those, some 50 or so students to whom he wrote letters and for whom he accepted some important degree of responsibility, they felt the pressure of his presence, the pressure of the presence of the master. Let's see, what have I got here? For some reason I should be able to get that, but not doing too well. Like to get one of my missing brackets, Sometimes I am much confused by the vagaries of computers in general and my computer, which I have not really named, Okay, so what have we? We have the need to move ahead to the point that we had reached. It's easy to skip. So we're talking about the think about the pressure of the presence of the master and his gaze upon you, as well as what is called the group gaze. Not easy, I think, to tolerate that, especially if that gaze has helped you isolate some foible, which then is exposed to everybody. But there is no judgment there because everybody has passed through these stages. And it was coming to me again the other day, Master DK's statement that all have sinned. This will mean the masters have, at some point in their long developmental history, have sinned. It will also mean that even the great Lord, who developed as a human being, although the dogmatic religions do not give that possibility any credence, but he too has sinned, and the Buddha, and so forth. All have sinned. It is the result of ignorance, and ignorance is inevitable. At first, we can't have a huge and embracing, capacious scope of consciousness. At the beginning, it has to grow. And in those growing periods, with their pains, we will sin. Fish sin and soma, as it is described in the Secret Doctrine, I think. And I think soma in this case is the body, and sin is the tendency to act amiss, and the fish tells us of the soul swimming in the great ocean of matter. Must the senior and the more advanced initiate disciples, note, initiate disciples, such as Roberto Assagioli was, an initiate and a disciple at the same time, halt or wait and step down their activities so as to give the less advanced the time and opportunity to measure up to them? The question, therefore, is, do senior disciples wait, or do junior disciples hinder? Again, we wonder, it is a question that has to be asked, and we do wonder about the dynamics there. Obviously, if we are a junior disciple and new to the ashram and a beginner, as DK says, we're going to do everything we can to measure up to the responsibility and the tone, the level set by disciples more senior to ourselves. Sometimes we will make it and sometimes we will not, but the idea is we at least are trying, and we're certainly not expecting the watering down of the standard to our own level, just because it must make us feel a little more comfortable and a little less stressed and under the pressure of the presence of the ashramic gaze and the presence of the master. I would assure you that the standard of measurement is not a dead level. And I would assure beginners that they cannot hinder the advanced members of an ashram. But, and this is important because quite a number of DK's students in his peripheral groups did just the following, but that they can throw themselves out of the sphere of activity, though not out of the group. Now that's an interesting idea. The group containment of these disciples remains, but the disciple may show himself or herself unfit to be included in the particular sphere of activity that needs emphasis of the moment. I'm thinking about those who had, it's a little different, they had reached their high water mark and they were not invited to be part of the group of 24, which undertook further studies and meditations and responsibilities, but they were not thrown out of the group thereby. It is the unready and the untrained who do the waiting, and not the ready and the truly dedicated. And again, I would suppose that if that statement has the proper effect upon us, we will just be determined to prepare ourselves and not be listed among the unready and the insufficiently dedicated. So the path does wind uphill all the way, and greater pressure is put upon us. And if we're like Master Moria, we can say, well, burden me still more as I enter the beautiful garden. Or we can complain about the burdens of discipleship, which would hardly be an indication of our worthiness to participate in those new responsibilities that will come upon us when we actually move closer to the center and heart of the ashram, who is the master. The task of the master is to stimulate as many as possible in his group to work consistently on levels of spiritual activity, wherein the fire of the will to love may dominate. D.K. says, please use the book Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, to attract to the ashram new potential members. Apparently, that book, and we're studying it right now, has a magnetic draw. And in the clarity with which it presents ashramic process, it does tend to draw in those who are worthy. So as many as possible. It's a bit of a numbers game in a way. I mean, the more worthy people who are drawn towards the ashram and then from the periphery of the ashram into the interior of the ashram, the better the prospect for service, the better the prospect to make sure that the higher points of tension reach the lower strata. Frequently, a part of the ashram is still struggling with the first stages in the task of understanding the fires of mind. I mean, don't we all know people who are in this stage? You know, I can identify periods in my life when I've gone through that, and the fires of the will to love were not exactly dominant, foremost in my mind. But you become more experienced as you go. Now, these fires of mind must be first comprehended and their fiery essence quenched before the fire of the will to love can flow through the disciple. It's one thing, you know, to read the books and gather a lot from them, and quite another thing to be a loving and integrated aspect of the ashram and carry that love and mind together to others. If we manage to respond to the higher indications of Venus, we will be able to do that. The point to be grasped, he said, is that the work of the ashram goes on, and disciples and initiates whose hearts are aflame continue to work unimpeded. This covers the individual reaction to the ashramic personnel. Their hearts are aflame. Well, there's another good opportunity, friends, to test ourselves. Is our mind aflame and acting like what? A flywheel or a spinning wheel that, as he tells us, I think in cosmic, in white magic, that casts off that which approaches? Or do we have this magnetic solar fire operating through the heart aflame? But where all the group are aflame with love and are living souls, then the ashram becomes a vital center or vortex of force and dynamically effective. This is going to be another one of those important statements. Yeah. Aflame with love, all the group. And are living as souls. So here's the question for us. Am I aflame and living as a soul? Is my group aflame and living as a soul group? Well, maybe right away, certain deficiencies will occur or be noticed. The effort of the masters who work through the methods of forming ashrams, not all do apparently, is to bring about as rapidly as possible this unity of love and intention. Will's good, love, goodwill. Love and will. It is only the beginner who is preoccupied with his individual effect in the ashram. It seems I feel quite compelled to keep the indigo color going here. The effort of the masters who work through the forming of ashrams is to bring about as rapidly as possible this unity of love and intention. It is only the beginner who is occupied with his individual effect in the ashram. The trained, and I would say hence, released disciples are more concerned with the task to be carried on and with the work to be done. An individual disciple may suffer in his personality as a result of the failure of his group brothers to understand or to arrest the fire of their minds. But he goes on steadily with the work, and his personal effectiveness as a serving unit remains unaffected. So that puts us in our place and tells us that concern with the ashramic personnel is no indication of advancement, because the eyes are still upon the personal individual self. So it's only the beginner who is preoccupied with his effect in an ashram. Now, what about us? Are we looking at that effect? Are we trying to enhance our influence within an ashram, or more likely within an outer group? It would indicate that we are not trained and therefore released disciples who are more concerned with the task to be carried on and with the work to be done. The task and the work, these are the watchwords. And the personal factors, well, they're going to be dealt with if they become obstructive. Now, an individual disciple, and we might say here, more advanced, may suffer in his personality as a result of the failure of his group brothers to understand, because from the mind alone, we will not get understanding. From the fiery mind alone, we will not achieve understanding, or to arrest the fires of their minds. But he goes on steadily. That is, the more advanced disciple, with his work and his personal effectiveness as a serving unit, remains ineffective. Unaffected. He knows that someday they will be liberated from themselves. In the meantime, he labors to offset their influence, and to this extent, his task is harder, but he knows that they are on their way to understanding. He knows, too, that at present, they cannot help but see in him, and even the master, the very qualities which are dominating in them. For, my brother, we see in others that which is in us, even when it is not there at all, or to the same extent. That's going to be a really one of those watchword kind of statements. We see in others what is in us, even when it is not there at all, or to the same extent. We might say that when Jesus was chosen by the people to be crucified, a great act of projection was occurring. He had been named the King of the Jews, and the tendency towards wanting power and selfish influence was projected upon him. And so they said, give us Barabbas and not Jesus. We will save Barabbas. Disciples need to learn the distinction between true analytical insight and so-called criticism. This is a really important factor to distinguish. A master does not criticize the members of his ashram. He seeks to analyze for them, and DK is always saying this, you know, let me help you analyze this situation. He seeks to analyze for them the points wherein they may hinder the usefulness of the service of the ashram. There is a basic distinction between this constructive aid and the criticism, which is based on a sense of personal superiority and a love of fault finding. I guess we have to take these statements to heart. There is a basic distinction between the constructive aid of helping a student analyze his situation and whereby he may be holding the group back in some way, and this ordinary mode of criticism based on, well, self-inflation, personal superiority, and the love of fault-finding. Yes, there are those who love fault-finding. And it is one of the key causes, I think maybe along the third ray line, one of the key causes of glamour. With self-pity and suspicion. So we have to know the difference between, or what is the motive behind what may appear as criticism and a truly benevolent analysis, which may reveal something not so pleasant, but useful eventually to the disciple. Okay. I think because of what's coming up for me, up to page 730, I have to call it a day here, or at least an hour. And move on to prepare. So at least you'll get this today. And you can tell how sentence after sentence, such important principles relating to the functioning of an ashram do appear. So this is program 14, and the day is the 11th. And the pages, at least up to page 730, and we'll begin with program 15 on the six stages of discipleship. And we'll begin with page 730, and we don't know what day we will start this. Now, as I say, I ran into some difficulty with the sudden disappearance of the sudden disappearance of my text. So if for some reason the section I just went over was done before, well, at least it wasn't done in exactly the same way. So friends, we will continue, I think up till page 770 something. I think we have I'm not sure how far it goes. Part 7. 749 to 764. Well, anyway, we have some work to do. Still, another 30, 40 pages in this section, but take it to heart and realize how important it is to become truly a member of the Master's Ashram, not because of any status, but because one has qualified. One has qualified. Okay. I hope you enjoy your studies. And lots of love from all of us here. We are considering ourselves on the communications team, and Tuya and I work together, as you know, and a number of Michaels and Mikhails, and we're all on the communications team, and BL and Joe Waltz, and we're trying to get all this to you so you can go still more deeply. Okay. See you soon, and bye-bye for now.